back to Back in My Play. This is episode number 53. This is three straight weeks of Back in My Play because that's the thing. Once you get started, you can't stop. And I had to contact one of my favorite guests, maybe my favorite guest. He's been on the show more than anyone, and that is Mike Micah. Mike, how you doing?
Doing great, Kevin. It's awesome to be back. It's been probably too long since I've been on the show. And since we've last talked, so much has been going on.
Well, iDarb is out.
Yeah, iDarb finally made it out. And you were one of the first. You were the first podcast I ever went on after we showed iDarb. And your show kind of chronicled the evolution of that game. And now it's out, and it's been doing really well.
You should totally, if this is like the first time that you're checking into the podcast or hearing Mike on the show, go back to the previous episodes. I think this is going to be like number five now that you've been on. And including the Neo Geo Pocket episode, which, you know, goes without saying you should check out. But yeah, just kind of like seeing how things kind of built, you know, on top of each other. And then it finally came out, and it was, I don't think I've talked to you on Skype since it's come out, but immediately, like, you gave me that download code and I checked it out. I'm like, holy crap, the Back of My Play logo is in there. And then I'm like watching Giant Bomb, like, oh my god, like the Back of My Play logo is on Giant Bomb's like video stream. So seriously, thank you so much for putting that in. That is like the coolest thing to see.
That's great. I still love seeing that logo when I watch people stream the game and everything. And it's another thing too to know that I can tell you right now that logo's probably been seen probably 30 million times now based off stats. So it's like it's kind of nuts that it's getting that much exposure. And the game itself, it's nuts that the game's been getting as much exposure as it has. It launched on Super Bowl Sunday, which should have been the kiss of death, and it had 16 years of gameplay in a single day on that day. So it's awesome. Just going gangbusters right now. We couldn't be happier.
I mean, when you think of it, it's like it's almost like the perfect day because you're going to have a bunch of people over. Like already there's like the nice NFL affiliation with Xbox. So people are going to, you know, maybe they have that Xbox fired up for that almost like second screen interaction type stuff. And then that Super Bowl halftime show, it wasn't bad, but, you know, instead of doing that, you can play some iDarb and then you can just – like, it has just been nuts to see the reaction from that game, and you guys must be super happy because I've seen nothing but incredibly positive stuff, like, even from, Greg over at Kind of Funny Games. Like, those guys have been absolutely loving it, and you got to do some, or talk to them. So it's just been, like, really great, and just super happy for you and everyone else on the team because if anyone else deserves it, it's you guys. You just put so much heart and so much love into that game, and it's great to see that everyone out there is really enjoying it. Now it's like it is a staple on every Xbox One because you guys also partnered with Xbox to make it part of the Xbox Games on Gold.
That's right, and thanks for all that too, because like it, before we launched, I still had no idea what was going to happen with this thing or if anybody would even understand it or whatever. And now it's kind of weird. I'll go to parties, or I'll go to somebody's house, or I'll even go to a bar, and I'll see them like set up iDarb for play at a bar, which is insane. And it's like sitting there looking like, I can't believe, like, even just the average person, bar going person, is going to enjoy this game, and they do. They all get into it and everything. It's just nuts.
Well, those NBA Jam machines are just not standing up to the test of time. You need something.
Yeah, those CRTs
else.
Are all dying, so all they have to do now is play iDarb.
The CRTs are dying. The buttons are sticking, and the bar owners and the arcade operators are not taking care of those machines. But now I do want to mention you mentioned the logo, and of course Lloyd Parker, the Par Master on Twitter, the designer of that logo. Huge props out to him because he's also created, you know, the portable version, the Japanese console version, and also most recently did like the next generation version with the Nintendo 64, Sega Saturn, and PlayStation 1. And outside of seeing the logo in iDarb, seeing Hip Tanaka wearing it at a DJ session is just like holy crap. So you know, thank you to you, and thank you to the guys at H4 for setting that up, and of course for Lloyd for making an awesome design. So if you want, you know, a logo, you know, go to @theParmaster, hit him up, and he's just incredible. And I have no idea how to design stuff. I just said I want a logo that has like retro consoles on it, and I want it to look like it was made in the 80s, and he delivered like, you know, totally delivered. So that is a guy that you should head up. So, man, there's so many places that I want to go with this, but maybe I'm curious, since you mentioned you got to kind of like see the reaction immediately, not just, you know, you gave out tons of codes, you know, just to the audience on Twitter, just your audience, people that were fans and that were following the development of iDARP. So you got to see almost immediately what the reaction was like. Is that kind of, was that like just a little weird to be able to see feedback on the fly and compared to just like a retail release where you send it out and you're like, you wait 3 months to see what anyone thinks?
Well, it was one of these things where all year long I've been promising we'd have it out by the end of the year. And our deal, we're going to do the games with gold, and we're coming so close to our submission time that none of us wanted to risk that window. So we had to push it to the next available window, which would be February. But I'm like, but the game's done now. So I was talking with Microsoft, and they actually had the idea of like, well, we can give you a bunch of code so you can get it out to some people if you want, and especially the ones who've been really asking for it or whatever. I'm like, oh, yeah, that'd be great. So they gave me 1,000 codes. And I don't think they were expecting me to just start giving them all away like candy, especially online. I think they were expecting to be a little more private or something. And so I just started handing them out to everybody that even like contributed or said nice things about the game, whatever, on Twitter. And I didn't expect the storm that would soon follow, because everybody wanted a code. Obviously, like a free game that nobody else has, of course they want a code. And so the odd thing about it, though, is once the code was out, this game was built for streaming, so being able to hand out codes, and within hours, we saw somebody start streaming it on Twitch. Mm-hmm. And not only were they streaming it, but we're able to go in and interact with the game, because you have that crazy hash bomb social interaction. So it was so surreal to watch this guy play. I still remember his name, his handle, which was like LXKiller9000, I think. And he was sitting there playing, and then we would mess with him, and then just see him flipping out on this live stream because we were doing that. And it was like magic. And since that first stream, more streams started showing up. And I like to say in hindsight that we planned it, but it was really an organic kind of marketing that came out of it, because everybody wanted to stream the game and show off that they had it. And it was a game that really encouraged people to interact through those streams. So it was kind of like this built-in marketing that none of us really understood the magnitude of. And we didn't realize how many people stream and watch games. I mean, I knew there was a lot, mm-hmm. but I didn't think that many would watch our game. And the kind of marketing we had going into that Super Bowl Sunday, I don't think we could have paid for that kind of marketing. It just kind of all clicked and worked really well. It was exciting.
Yeah. Do you think companies are, you know, I guess bigger publishers in general are not necessarily seeing the impact that live streaming can have? Because I know, you know, there's some companies that are now trying to, you know, get some revenue from people that are either streaming games or, you know, creating videos based on the game's content. Just from your end, did you see that it was, you know, well worth just like saying, hey, take this game and, you know, talk about it, you know, stream it as much as you can?
Oh, it was so worth it. The amount of the word of mouth that we had something like 15 million impressions going into the holiday from it. And like, we can't pay for that. Wow. And larger companies might be able to do that. But it's one of these things where I think in hindsight now, at the time, I would not have really understood where we're going with it. But in hindsight, that audience is so enormous, and giving them access to something and allow them to play it, share it, and talk about it it's mind-blowing how huge that market is. And I don't think any major publisher really understood it. They understood that there's a lot of people who watch games, mm-hmm. but I don't think they understood that there's value in trying to interact with that audience. Because up until iDARB and Twitch Plays Pokemon, which was before us, that audience was always passive. So the minute you can make them have some sort of hand in what you're doing or make it an interactive experience, this enormous passive audience can suddenly do something, and they're energized to do it, because normally they would just sit there and watch anyways. Now they're more likely to interact and engage and share when you have some sort of two-way street with those guys.
Now you have this great community, and even a listener, fan, and supporter of the show, Adam Silvers, he basically took the ball and ran with it when it came to like iDARB, you know, creating tons of characters and, you know, doing tons of stuff on Twitter. So, you know, again, it's just been really, really great to see. And now, like, down the road, do you guys have plans to do anything, you know, with that community? Is iDARB Con coming up in 2016, anything like that?
I think we'll have something along those lines. We're working on some things right now. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously people like Adam Silvers who, like, man, he's been amazing. He's one of those guys that one, you, when you meet him, you're like, I feel like I've known this guy my whole life. And two, he's so energized and such a positive guy that, like, in times when we were just stressed out and everything like that, to have Adam in your court was awesome because it just made us, like, want to make Adam happy. Mm-hmm. And so we definitely want to give back, and we also want to involve people like Adam a bit more in IDARB and also future things we have going on. So we're working right now on some new concepts that new concepts for IDARB, mm-hmm. but also follow-on games beyond IDARB. And we're going to try to amplify the user interaction, kind of like the experience we had with IDARB, with crowd designing and having the community have a big say in it. We're going to try to amplify that and see how far we could take that. And so it's going to be exciting. I think going into E3, we'll have some things to announce, and the process is just going to get crazier.
Well, I mean, you don't have to break anything here, but we did get a lot of tweets from people just with the general question of, you know, what's next for IDARB? Are there any plans for new content updates or sequels? Like what's the plan?
There are. There's a lot of plans for IDARB. And unfortunately, we were hoping to have an update out sooner rather than later. But every time we think we have the update ready to go, some new thing comes available that we can use to make the game even better. Mm-hmm. So we're working our way towards the first update. Our goal was to have two updates before E3. The first update being kind of like a minor upkeep. There's a lot of these little bugs that are in there that people have pointed out. There's things like fart dashing, which is this technique people figured out in the game. I love the name for it that people came up with. We want to balance all that stuff out. So we have an update that's going to kind of tweak all that stuff and kind of lay the groundwork for a major update to follow. Mm-hmm. The biggest being the multiplayer side of it, because we want to make sure that as many people can play and the best experience possible and this sort of thing. So we're overhauling the multiplayer completely. And it's not an easy task because the game was never really meant to be online anyways. It was originally a local multiplayer game. Mm-hmm. So now it's almost like a full rewrite because we're trying to get the multiplayer to deliver on the idea that we can have up to 4 to 8 people online with unique Xboxes and that sort of thing. So we're seeing how far we can push that. And unfortunately, we're up against physics on it too, because the kind of game it is, it was not... it's really hard to do this sort of game and have that many players online with unique Xboxes. So we're sorting that out. But that's a huge undertaking. That's our number one priority. And outside of that, we have extra content and extra features in the game. So we have this thing called like a halftime Olympics, which allows you to string up a whole bunch of halftime events so you can just play those. Mm-hmm. We have new arenas and some other things coming along. And we have new announcement phrases. We have new creative stuff and everything like that in the game, and also the Twitter interaction we have in the game, which takes about 10 seconds to tweet a hash bomb into the game from when you tweet it to getting in the game. We've reworked all that so it's instantaneous like Twitch. So all these, like, a ton of minor things and a bunch of major overhauls coming soon, and that's going to be basically coming together in a major update this summer is the plan, which will hopefully give people enough stuff to work from for like online tournaments and everything else and beyond. So we're going to keep updating the game. And the plan is to keep updating and making it better and better and better. We don't plan on sequelizing it as much as just doing the Minecraft approach mm-hmm. and just updating it as we go.
Has any studio optioned the rights for IDARB, the animated film?
IDARB, the animated film. No, but it's been interesting.
Backstory there, Mike. You got to, give yourself some credit. There's a lot of, I mean, the characters themselves, it's right.
That single-player campaign was pretty funny.
It was great.
Frank Cifaldi wrote that. And the single-player was part of the game and not, and part and not. We almost took it out at the end. And then the final draft, we're like, that's just too funny. We got to keep it in. And we also, I don't know if you've seen the shirts. We have Yeti.com has the IDARB, official IDARB t-shirts. We have this crazy Blades of Steel-style box cover t-shirt that shows Coffee with these big muscular arms and muscular legs, like... I don't know. You just got to see it in mom. You're like, one of the moms is in there. There's a mustache cop and there's a duck. It's just insane. Somehow it all makes sense, though.
It totally if fits. And if you haven't, I mean, there's a lot of people that, I mean, the console wars have been outstanding for this this generation. So if you're just jumping into this generation on Xbox One, make sure you get on that shop and check out IDARB. And just in terms of the amount of replayability, you're not going to find a better game out there. Let's go into some other topics. I'm sure we're going to be coming back to IDARB. And one of the big stories this last couple weeks in games is, and this is perfect for you because in terms of like preservation, the ESA, and I won't go deep into the story, but more or less they're trying to stop people from being able to recreate online environments for online games when they cease to be supported from their original publisher, and trying basically people trying to make sure that, you know, 10 years from now, you're going to still be able to jump into those online universes, even if they're not supported from the publisher or the developer anymore. So as someone, you know, like yourself, that is really a preservationist, like you're making sure that these games are literally going into museums if need be. How do you feel about something like that?
I'm really torn, because the ESA is a right to pursue protecting intellectual property of various companies. That sort of thing. Piracy is bad. We all know it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, why this seems like such a gray area to so many people is I think back on, remember Habitat that was on Quantum Link by Lucasfilm back in the day? Have you heard of that?
No.
It was a game developed by the guys who did all those classic adventures from Maniac Mansion, you know, Ron Gilbert and all them. But it was an online, massively multiplayer game. It was an adventure, but it was also like Animal Crossing, and all these, you could send messages to each other. You can meet up and go places, and you did all this stuff way back in like the mid-80s.
Wow.
And you were doing it on Quantum Link. It was this amazing thing. And in fact, a lot of people, like from World of Warcraft to, I mean, you name all your MMOs and everything online, like which we call EverQuest and everything, mm-hmm. everybody cites Habitat as a huge inspiration. And where is Habitat right now? Can you play it? No, you can't. Is there any way that you can recreate it? No. Well, is there any chance we'll ever see it? And it doesn't seem likely. And it's because there was nobody around to preserve it. The only things that we do have available of it are aspects of it that were pirated. And so thanks to piracy, I hate to say, we have pieces of it. And we also have pieces of the game that were preserved by people who were on the team who took copies of aspects of it when they were not supposed to. But the actual original game, who knows where it is? I don't know the full story of it. Maybe like some of the guys on the team know where it is or whatever. But ultimately, you can't just bring that game up and like even just see a video of it or anything. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I think I look at that as an example, and I think about where things are going right now, like what happens when, you know, some of these games are shut off. And because there's no active preservation or no efforts being made by companies that are behind these to preserve them, because it takes time and money, and usually when they shut them down, it's because there's no more money left. What is a process that can be had that preserves these experiences so that future generations can look back and refer to these games? There is none right now. And we're working really hard with different organizations to try to figure out, is there a way that we could preserve it? Mm-hmm. Could, say, Sony Online work with the Library of Congress to at least just take whatever they have and preserve it, so that when Sony later decides, or whoever gets the rights later, decides they want to try to revisit it or bring it out as an example or whatever, that the Library of Congress will have an always working archive? That would be amazing. And that's one thing that can be done right now, because Library of Congress is doing that. Other organizations like, you know, the MAID or Computer History Museum or the Strong Museum or the Video Game History Museum, all these guys, they're all willing to do the same thing. And it would be at no cost to these corporations. But getting these corporations to spend even the time to gather the materials or ship something or do whatever, even if it was paid for, is very challenging. And that's what's so frustrating about this, is because the ESA is trying to do the right thing, and there's no easy solution. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I think the best thing that we can do right now at this moment in time is, as things are being shut down, people on the team need to work with their management or whatever to coordinate with, like, say, the Library of Congress, and try to at least get this stuff put in one spot and a place that everybody knows where it is. And that's not going to be pirated or whatever. It's going to be protected. And that we just got to educate people.
It's I've been running into this, you know, a similar situation just these last couple months, because I was thinking of, do I hold on to my Xbox 360, my PS3? There's all these digital games that, you know, I purchased over the years, and literally my Xbox 360 was at my mom's house because she was using it for Kinect stuff, for exercise. And like, this is the 360 that I've had ever since release. And The most magical thing for me, and this is kind of related, but I think it's funny, but, I go back, and my hard drive has been mostly wiped out because you needed space for other stuff. But then I can go back into my purchase history, and there's games that have been delisted that I can still download because I purchased them. And I just, I made a decision right then. I need to make sure I hold on to this thing. And I re-downloaded all that stuff to make sure I have it. And many games that you actually developed and that you brought to the console, you know, these arcade ports. And then, of course, you know, what you guys did with Street Fighter, making sure that I can, you know, have this for as long as that hard drive is going to keep spinning. Exactly. And, you know, it still makes me think like, all right, well, maybe that gives me 10, 15 years, then what's that hard drive going to, what's going to happen to that hard drive? And then is it going to be gone? Is Microsoft going to hold on to this stuff? And we've talked about it a lot, and you brought up the same points, like who's going to make sure this stuff is taken care of for just museums? Like, I'm not even that I need to play it. I just want to, you know, make sure I can play that awesome HD edition of, you know, Street Fighter when I want to, or at least see it.
Yeah, there's no, there needs to be a central organization. There hasn't been one yet that's stepped up. And I don't know how we accelerate that, because I've been involved in groups trying to do that. Mm-hmm. I've seen other groups try to do it. And it really comes down to getting organizations to take it seriously more than anything. And that's a tough thing. Again, like I said before, when the time comes to make the decision to preserve something like this, and the most critical time is usually when there is no time, money, or resources available to do it. Mm. And that's the only time you find out about it. Because like they will not announce something's really going away very often until it's too late. And so I wish there was like a magic answer to it all. But one thing that has been good is everybody's pretty diligent about it right now. Not everybody, but there's a lot of people who are. And when a game gets announced that it's going to be delisted or whatever, people are out there making sure they're backing up their hard drives with the game on it, so just in case there's a way to do whatever. And it's not pirating. They're backing up their own software or whatever. But ultimately, when they delisted a game I worked on, War of the Worlds, I was like, I don't have a copy of it. And I don't know where our archive is. We thought we had it and we couldn't find it. And I was kind of relieved to find out that there was a pirated version of it for the 360 on BitTorrent. And only because I'm like, that might be the only surviving artifact of that game when the when Xbox gets shut down or whatever. Hmm. And it wasn't like I was happy it was being pirated or anything. I was just happy that at least there was a copy somewhere just in case.
Yeah.
But ultimately, how great would it be if we can just like rest assured that the Library of Congress has a copy of every digital game ever made? Mm-hmm. That would be awesome. They do that with film. They do that with everything else. So when you go there, you see that they have like nitrates of some of the oldest films. And that sort of thing needs to happen with software. And it's been like a huge effort of the Library of Congress to try to get people to even recognize that they even do it. Mm-hmm. And shows like this and obviously other events have been trying to educate people with that. But it's still kind of scary.
Yeah, I think it was I can't remember who, maybe it was Frank Cifaldi that was on Retronauts talking about this years ago. And, mm-hmm. You know, seriously, it's just, it's got me, and it got me, like, eventually what my decision was is that I got a 256 gigabyte flash stick, and I made sure I then downloaded it all onto my flash stick now that 360 supports USB storage and stuff like that. So I mean, we're getting to this point, folks. If you're thinking about, you know, holding on to that 360 or getting rid of it, I spent hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And it was great. I, you know, loaded up Wolf of the Battlefield and I got to play that again. Like,
yeah,
it's just games that, again, you just worked on half of that stuff, and it's just how things worked out. All right, so let's go. This is kind of a random question, but video game music comes up a lot on this show, and I was just curious, is there any series that comes to mind that you're just very fond of the music, whether it's across generations or a single game? Is there any one series or game that comes to mind for you?
Yeah, that's pretty good. You know what, my brain goes a ton of them. Like, obviously I love the Final Fantasy series, and I don't even play Final Fantasy games that much, but I will buy the soundtracks because I think they're beautiful. And I do it blindly. It's like, oh, there's a new Final Fantasy soundtrack. I'm buying it.
Tell me you've checked out Theater Rhythm.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's awesome.
It's so good. And so that I do, but it's not like it's a game series I play very often. But if I think back on like impactful soundtracks, there's a couple things that come to mind. Like, one, there was like for a big chunk of my life, I was really into the Wipeout series of games. And so they're kind of like mixtapes of sorts for a soundtrack, because you'll have like Prodigy and all those guys on it. Mm-hmm. I would just love those things. I'd always pop them in for if I went on a bike ride or whatever. But two series particularly that stand out to me. Well, I call one a series, but it's really Ueda's games, which is like Shadow of the Colossus and Ico.
Yep.
Those haunting soundtracks, like I could just pop that in and listen to it, and it just like takes me there to that world and everything. Those are brilliant soundtracks. And the entirety of the Mario series, because it is such a happy, happy soundtrack. And I think they're brilliant. And they dared to do different things. Like, who would put banjo in a game, or you know, those sorts of things, right? Like, it's very Miyamoto. And not that he had like a big hand. It's like what was the composer's name?
Koji Kondo.
Yeah, thank you. It's really him. He brings so much to those games. And whenever I listen to any of that music, it just makes me happy about games. It makes me want to play games. And he in every game he touches and every soundtrack he ever does, it's just brilliant. It's something that I love when somebody takes something like a game soundtrack and brings something from somewhere entirely, like from an entirely different place, yet makes it sound like that's exactly what it needed to be. There's moments in like those Mario games where like I can't imagine like what the conversation was to say this is what this has to sound like, because if you look at a Mario game, what it is, and forget that we've grown up with it, it's really absurd and bizarre. And like, where do you even start to say what the sound of those games are? Mm-hmm. Like, it's real easy to say, well, of course it sounds like this or that right now. But like, just try to go through that exercise of like, you know nothing about Mario. You're looking at this plumber who has the ability to go in and out, inside and out of pipes and travel to different places in this bizarre world to rescue a princess. And you're like stepping on turtles and all sorts of stuff. It's like, what is that sound if you didn't know that audio? Like, what is that? It just blows my mind. And so to me, that it's something I always think back on. Like, if I had no concept and I was starting from square one with that, I don't know how he managed to come up with that sound.
Yeah, just two quick things to note there. First, if you're listening, you haven't checked out Digging in the Carts, the Red Bull Music Academy series. I talked to the two guys that produced that on an episode a couple months ago, but check that out. It's free to watch. They're like 15-minute episodes, and it's just exactly what you're talking about. Just these composers from the 80s and then that went on to the 90s, and composers from Final Fantasy, and just trying to figure out their influences and how they got into all this stuff. And then also compare Super Mario Brothers to Super Mario 3D World, and just compare those two soundtracks. And the 3D World soundtrack, I have it on my phone. I'm waiting I'm taking it on my flight tomorrow, because whenever I hit turbulence, I get really nervous. Like, I hate flying. So I end up listening to like a Link Between Worlds soundtrack, and I end up listening to Super Mario 3D World, just because it's just, like you said, it's super happy music, and it can get me to chill out when I'm like gripping the armrests of my seat.
Yeah, and it does take your mind off everything else, because it's so joyful and just like perfect in what it is. And like, it doesn't fit anything else anymore. I can't put that music into it. Like, try playing another game and put Mario music in it. It just doesn't fit. It just fits with Mario. It just works perfectly with that. But yeah, that's great. And then there's another soundtrack I want to throw out there that I've gone back to time and time again, and it's the Secret of Mana soundtrack.
Yeah, oh my God.
Which... that one, oh man, I've heard different interpretations of it and everything like that. And of course, the original soundtrack, and it still blows my mind. I can just, the music, let alone just on the Super Nintendo, is brilliant. It's so well done. And it's the kind of score that like rivals some of the greatest film scores. And that's one I can just put in any moment. And it's just amazing.
I've tried to play through that game just so I could listen to more of the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Instead, I just bought the CD. And I just got the CD soundtrack. And again, this, if you're ever in Japan, you can get this stuff from Amazon Japan. It's just so amazing how easy it is to get the soundtracks for all these 16-bit games, 8-bit games. And they're even remastering all this stuff and reprinting CDs if you want to get access to your favorite soundtracks. And surprisingly, iTunes has quite a few video game soundtracks in really high, high quality and super cheap. Like, I got the Klonoa. I just, discovered how awesome Klonoa is last week. And I bought the soundtrack for $5. And it's like 50 songs. It's like 3 hours of music for $6. It's just
it's a crazy deal.
Pro tip. All right, great. So now I know what music I'm going to be putting into another show.
And did you know that in the Secret of Mana Japanese version of the game, the high-res title screen sequence, did you ever see that?
No.
It differs from the US. They actually have a high-res version of the title screen sequence that's a little... It's got animation, and it's this really beautiful kind of intro that was only in the Japanese version that plays perfectly to that music. And it's worth seeking that out, too, if you can find it.
It's like literally $2 in Japan. So
yeah, it's one of those things where I've recommended people, like, just import it because it's just worth having the different intro.
Man, old video games are great. I remember why. You know, I've listened to all those soundtracks again. All right, so it's another thing I wanted to ask you about is genres that you've never, you know, developed for. Are there any genres that you feel like you'd want to take a stab at? If, you know, again, it's that idea that we talked in the past about unlimited budget, or just say you have the budget that you need for it. Are there any genres that you would want to, you know, develop for?
You know, one I haven't done, but the older I get, the more I want to do it. And maybe it's something that's just like with age, but real-time strategy. I'm really hankering to do a real-time strategy game. And along the lines of Total Annihilation, if you remember that game.
Of course, yeah.
I love Total Annihilation. And of course, I like Command & Conquer and all those other games, but Total Annihilation was kind of arcade enough for me. And there's also, what was the other game? Well, of course, like the Nintendo series, Advance Wars, right? Is that what?
Yep.
I'd like to kind of merge real-time with that kind of simplicity of Advance Wars. Mm-hmm. So there's something there. And there's another game on the DS called Glory Days 2. I don't know if you ever played those games.
No.
Glory Days or anything. It's a game that I think it's based off an old computer game, but it's essentially two factions, one on the left, one on the right, and you're spawning characters, and you can also command vehicles, and you're just trying to control points between your position and the enemy position. Mm-hmm. Simple as that. But it is so much fun, and it's all real time. And there's something about that mix of things, and lately I've been kind of going back to these things, as well as going back to games like Return Fire, where I see there's something I want to kind of synthesize from all those games and try to experiment with. So in my spare time lately, I've been kind of dabbling with the notion of some sort of real-time strategy game.
Total Annihilation is a game that was on the counter of my Babbage's for 99 cents. They used to make like shareware CDs.
Yep.
And I got so much gameplay out of that 99 cents because I couldn't afford the real game.
Yeah.
So I just played, like, I think it was even clocked at like 30 or 60 minutes. So I would just kind of play it over and over and over again, get a little bit farther every single time. And I've played very few strategy games, but just from the graphics on the back of that CD case, and we had like a Pentium 1 with a CD drive, or Pentium 100 with a CD drive. So it was just powerful enough to play that game. And, that is like what got me into that, and then eventually led to playing a lot of Red Alert in high school.
Wow. It was my gateway drug to RTS games. Until then, like, there were other RTS games, but I wasn't quite into them. Mm-hmm. Total Annihilation did it for me. And I remember that moment when I was able to, if I recall correctly, you can become like this big mech or this like kind of mega robot thing.
Sounds about right.
And you could just, I mean, you just walked in the middle of like an army and just laid waste to them. It was just awesome because you're just auto firing and doing all that stuff. And that feeling of power from that was just so awesome. But it was real time. Like, not only was it a real time strategy game, but it was also real time graphics, which I was used to, like the sprite based RTS games, that sort of thing. But this was like 3D. It looked great. It was fast. And it was really easy to get into.
I'm going to feel bad if I don't mix in some of these listener questions. So this is from John Radical on Twitter. I'd love to hear about your process of paring down your collection and maintaining maintaining a larger collection.
Oh, process. This is an ongoing process of a process. One thing I've done lately, though, is I started to really focus on things that that I think are important for me, since there's so many other people now collecting and there's so many other museums coming up, there's no need for me to have just random retail things or whatever. So I've really pared down my focus now being on more esoteric stuff like prototypes or oddities. Like, you know, like a good example would be like the Half-Life Dreamcast disc and stuff, right? Things that are like ephemera, like the fax exchanges between like John Romero and Scott Miller and that kind of stuff. That stuff is more or less what I'm trying to focus more on now, less on just everything. Like, I have a huge N64 collection, but I think I need to probably pare that down because I have no need really for it. So I've been trying to figure out what my focus is. I'm not entirely sure what that is yet, but I know it's not necessarily just having everything. So I'm starting to donate stuff or give stuff to other collectors that makes more sense for them. And then how to like handle the size of it, that I wish I could solve that. I'm like a Tetris master. I have a big room that somehow when we I had this minor flood in the room and I had to take out just half of the room, mm-hmm. and the half of the room filled what looked like maybe four times the entirety of the room when I like relocated it. And I don't understand how it even fit in the room previously. And so it was really just careful like packing in the space. So, it really comes down to, what I try to do is I try to organize everything into some sort of category. So everything associated with a platform is organized into one space. And compact it down. So, like, I have Genesis games that are in boxes, and then there's games that are in, like, kind of collector's boxes, and then I have loose carts, and loose carts are really compressed down. I don't actually, since I don't play them very often, I don't necessarily have to have them, like, in display mode or anything, so mm-hmm. I just pack them down. So, like, for every Genesis cart box, you can have, like, two deep of carts that are, like an array of, for every one of those kind of rows, you could fit, like, 8 to 12 Genesis carts or whatever. So I do everything by category that way. And what I've been kind of doing now is just pruning. Like I have so many magazines, but Frank Cifaldi is the magazine guy, so I don't need all those magazines. And so I've been kind of pruning my magazine collection, make sure people who collect those, like Frank or whatever, get those or whatever, but I don't need them as much necessarily. And now that everything's kind of digital, a lot of those magazines are available online, so I don't even really need that either. So I've kind of pruned that down too. But I have no real good rhyme or reason. I wish I could give advice on that stuff, but like I'm a hoarder in the worst sense. Like I'm watching these hoarding shows and I'm like, oh God, please don't let my wife call them up because like then I'll have to face that kind of controversy over what stays and what goes. And I'm not looking forward to that.
But it's not like a pile of newspapers.
Yeah, it's really those newspapers mean a lot to me. I can't get rid of them.
There is actually a funny, it's an interesting episode of Hoarders. I don't know if you saw the guy that was hoarding all the arcade stuff.
No.
Oh, man. It was, of course, I got forwarded that because that was when I owned 9 arcade machines in my living room. But see, you figure out other ways. Like you keep a lot of arcade machines at the office instead of having them at home.
I do. I'm looking right now at at a Joust, an iRobot, a Robotron, elevator action. I'm spinning my chair now. Marble Madness, ice cold beer. Smash TV, Tempest, Off the Wall, Qbert, Kickman, Rampart, and an MK3. And that's just in this one room that I'm kind of squirreled away in right now at the office. In the back, we have like a Tron and a bunch of other machines too. But yeah, the office, luckily I work in games, so I can bring all these arcade machines in the office. And I just reorganized my office where I sit, and I got these gigantic, we have this like really tall ceilings in our office, so I have these gigantic shelves. So I look like I'm in a warehouse. You walk in, and it's just like floor to ceiling, just like video game collectibles and everything. So it's bled out from the home, but not everybody has that opportunity, but that's how it is here.
That's a hell of a lineup, but tell me that's Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3 and just not Mortal Kombat 3.
It's Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3 for sure.
Just making sure. Otherwise we'd have to get you the upgrade kit.
I know. I know.
That's, I think one of the most fascinating things about just like collecting today is, like all the small communities that have popped up, like how supportive, if you ever, like need arcade stuff, just go to Clav and there's so many people that will help you out and you can get parts and all that stuff. So that stuff is very alive and well.
It's great because people are making reproduction parts for games that I thought I would never find, like right down to iRobot parts and that sort of thing. So
it's great. We did early in the week, I did an episode on Outrun, and I went through, I think I probably talked to you about this, but I went through like 4 Outrun machines, which created 2 working Outrun machines because of how, you know, fragile not just the boards are, but the gear assemblies inside of the steering mechanism is. And now there's this specific gear, I forget like the exact name of it, but like they've even gotten it down to like part number that people have been, they created new molds for it and created in this super awesome, durable plastic that won't crack.
That's awesome.
No, I'm sorry. It was originally plastic and then they created like a metal version of it so it will never wear down. So your Outrun will last forever until your Outrun boards, they're like Fabergé eggs. They just do not last.
Well, it's like the Qbert I have, like the audio board in Qbert is notorious for dying. and there's this replacement board that just takes care of all of it. And it's just a much smaller board, and I put it in the case. It just works great, and it'll last forever now. It's awesome.
Thank God for people that love this stuff.
I know.
Let's go to a question from Toad of Sky, and again, another super fan on Twitter. Wanted to know, what's the most difficult game that you had to that you had to work hard on to port to a console or a handheld? The hardest port job that you ever had to do.
You know, I think it was the first one, first real professional one I did. We probably talked about it before on the show, but it was NFL Blitz, I think.
Yeah.
And it's mainly because I didn't know anything about football. it's half technical, half that. Because like I'm the truest kind of like gamer in that I was oblivious to anything football. I was more prone to watch hockey or basketball anyway. But I said yes to a project that for all intents and purposes I thought was going to be easy. But going through it, I knew nothing. I was trying to like fast track all the rules of football. I was asking everybody I knew how the thing worked. I played the game a lot, and I thought I understood football, but I clearly didn't. There's that moment, which I think I brought up on a show before, but Midway asked me if they basically said, like, hey, we noticed that safeties aren't working. I remember cupping the phone because I was also by day working at Next Gen Magazine, and leaning over to my friend Tom Russo. I'm like, what's a safety? Then he explained it, and like he recalls me going pale because like I knew that it was going to be a very difficult thing to do at the point in the production. So it was very, very challenging. It was like also the game I was trying to prove myself that I could do a professional game, and I was doing it at night. So I was working at Next Gen Magazine. I would go home, my one-bedroom apartment with my girlfriend, and we'd have like two Midway testers staying with us in that apartment and like working all night with them. It was nuts. It was the craziest and. It was a short schedule, so it was like the craziest 3.5 months of my life just trying to get that game done.
You have not mentioned that before. That's hilarious. Oh, my God.
I'm surprised my girlfriend stuck with me, now wife, because I remember it was Jason Shiganaka and I can't believe I'm forgetting the other guy's name, two testers from Midway that just showed up, and they helped me get the game out the door. Steve Montano, that was the other guy's name. And I knew nothing, and they came in, and like it was great because it was the perfect thing where they realized I didn't know anything about football, but they didn't want to bust me. So they worked really hard with me to kind of make it work, and they were part of the team. And like by the end of it, like we all became like really good friends. And they would just report back to Midway, everything's going great, and then they would like work really hard with me, going like, okay, here's how this works. So it was awesome.
Speaking of that, it's always funny when people like tweet to the show and to you, like picked up another Mike Micah like Game Boy Color game.
Yeah.
I mean, again, the show does really bad things when it comes to video game price. It just jacks them up. So if you want to get NFL Blitz on the Game Boy Color, I would do it as soon as humanly possible.
It's funny. Like the price went up for Little Nicky after all my talk about Little Nicky over the year.
Yeah.
And now it's really hard to find Little Nicky.
It's the internet, man. Like you can just crazy. Like, control the market. Like it, thank God there's no like stock. And retro, unless you're like having a stockpile of like if I had 20 copies of Streets of Rage 2 and then did a Streets of Rage 2 episode and sold them on eBay, I'd be a horrible person.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about this on the show, but you tweeted about it a while back, and that was a I guess it was a not like a beta, but it was just like a prototype of Star Fox for the Game Boy Advance.
Yeah.
First, talk about that, because I think we just went back and forth on Twitter, and I think it was happening while I was recording a show. So I just said, breaking news, right. Mike Micah just found a Star Fox, you know, advance prototype.
So over the years, we would work with so many different people that they would send out basically EEPROM cartridges, and they wouldn't erase them. And we would also get demos from people or whatever. And I can't remember how I came across it. And it was like a surprise for me because like I was going through a hard drive during that night of your show, and I was finding all these old ROMs, and I'm looking and I'm like trying them out, and I had no idea what they were or where they came from. So I was posting various vines of different games, and I got really excited because I loaded that one up, and it blew my mind because I'm like, oh wait, this is Star Fox on GBA. And then I quickly Googled because I'm like, was this ever supposed to come out? And I couldn't find anything online. So that's when I started tweeting about it. And wow, a lot of people got interested in that game, of course. And I have no idea. Like, I was hoping somebody would come out of the woodwork and say that they had worked on that or knew about it, and nobody did. And I still have the ROM. I have it available. I'm going to find some way to at least let people see more of it and that sort of thing. But I have no idea where it came from, who worked on it, whether it's an official Nintendo thing or not. But it's not a complete version of Star Fox. It's the training sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe a little bit more, it's hard to kind of navigate because it's just so unfinished. But it runs great, and it runs on a GBA, and there's no extra hardware for it. So it's kind of neat. It's this weird anomaly.
Yeah. I don't know if it was, you know, they got like Dylan Cuthbert over in Japan or whatever, but who knows? That'll be cool to get some more info once it hits gets out on it. Speaking of that, I think it was last time we talked as well that you had recently found a version of Bomberman that you're working on for the Atari Jaguar. So any updates on that?
So Bomberman's in the hands of my brother with a friend of his who's actually, I don't know off the top of my head his name, but I think people in the Jaguar scene will probably know who he is. He works at Disney.
There's a Jaguar scene?
There is a Jaguar scene. It's a very active scene. I'm surprised. There's a lot of people who are just huge Jaguar fans, and they keep finding ways to make the Jaguar, like, give longevity to the Jaguar.
That's awesome.
And there's one particular guy. He works at Disney with my brother, and they met up, and he's helping my brother resurrect that game. So I don't have any, like, major update right now because I hear from my brother from Shanghai every so often. But last I heard from him, that progress is still going, and they intend to have some sort of release for it. So that I can't wait to see what that looks like. It's been so long since I've seen it, so I'm pretty stoked. Hopefully we'll hear something soon. I would think probably by summer.
All right, stay tuned. Make sure you're following Mike on Twitter. Let's go to another question that we got from the audience from Seven Devils. This is from NeoGaff. Just like the Sega Genesis collection, if you were to put a Nintendo collection together and could only pick one platform, I guess what platform would you pick? And, you know, what are some of the games that you would make sure to include?
It's funny because I would say for popularity's sake, I would pick the NES, but that is so overdone with emulation right now. It's hard for it to really make it stand out unless you can, like, find a lot of background material and that sort of thing, or cutting room floor stuff. But I would say NES is the smartest way to go. But then the one way I would want to go, actually, would be N64, because it's one of all the Nintendo platforms, it's one that's probably it's one that's not emulated very well. Mm-hmm. And not readily available to a lot of people. It has actually a stellar, like, catalog of games that a lot of people have overlooked. So things like Pokemon Snap or Tetrisphere or even like Road Rash 64 and these sorts of games are just lost. And a lot of people didn't realize they were that great. I've brought up before on the show too, like Rage Wars and stuff like that, multiplayer. Mm-hmm. And so, or GoldenEye even. Imagine like GoldenEye and Perfect Dark or whatever. Now, forget licensing or whatever, but if you can get a collection of N64 games that are emulated perfectly or even improved on with some sort of just basic up-resing or whatever, and forgetting, you know, kind of circumvent that crazy filtering and some of the Fog of War stuff that they had going on, I think that would be pretty exciting. Because if you look at that, I was just going through because I just got a Framemeister.
Nice. And so now I'm enjoying it.
I know, it took me forever. And I finally got one, and I'm reacquainting myself with the N64, and it finally looks okay on my television. And it always looked great on composite, as good as it could, but with the Framemeister, it looks even better. And I'm playing the hell out of stuff like Yoshi's Story, mm-hmm. and even like Extreme G and Extreme G2.
Hell yeah.
And these games, like, I forgot how good those games all were. And in hindsight, I would always kind of like bury the N64 in my head and just jump straight to GameCube and then to the Wii, and the N64 was just kind of forgotten. I'm just now having such a great time going back to all those N64 games. Mario Kart 64 is just brilliant. And, of course, in Mario 64, it's still, the original still stands tall compared to even some of the updates of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one thing, I'm not planning on buying a lot of stuff on my trip to Japan, but one of the things is probably going to be N64 stuff because it's still... It's actually super cheap in Japan. Like, N64 games are not really desirable there. And there's also a ton of games that came out there that didn't come out here that are just super weird. So you can just end up getting a handful of games for $10 and just figure out, you know, maybe it's probably an RPG, but if it's not, it could just be like a crazy action game based on an anime that you never heard of. And you'll be surprised like how good, you know, some of this stuff looks, because that was the console. Like, Nintendo was still, you know, pumping out a ton of N64 stuff, even with the PlayStation and the Saturn doing great in Japan at the time. So what else, I mean, you mentioned like Road Rash 64. Are there any other games that are like lesser known? I always bring up Duke Nukem 64 as being really great. Like, that is an awesome port, and it has four player split screen and bot, you know, it has like three bots that you can throw into if, you know, you were like me back then and had no one that wanted to play Duke Nukem 64. So, are there any other games that you would, you know, throw in that question?
The last version of Bomberman that came out in Japan only, wasn't in the US, was a 2D version of Bomberman. And it was like the best of the series all combined in one package. So you had a lot of the levels that were reminiscent of Super Bomberman 2 and Super Bomberman 5 and that sort of thing, all in one package just called Bomberman. That one is great. It's a really fun multiplayer game. And the animation's great and the audio's great. And hardly anybody even knows it exists. They just assume it's the 3D Bomberman games. Hmm. That one I really recommend. And what was some of the other ones that... Winback. Have you ever played Winback?
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, Winback's a great game and hardly anybody knows about it. They know about some of the later versions. Man. Yeah, it's Gears of War. And it was so well done and it was so ahead of its time. That's a great one to go back to and play on the N64. Highly recommend that one.
Oh, man. And they even did like an up-res version of it for maybe it was for like PS2 or something like that.
It just didn't feel like the N64 version, though. There's something magical about that N64 version.
It had such like almost a look of Time Crisis to me.
Yeah.
Like that's what like the feel that I got from it. It just was that was a rental for me, and I played the crap out of that game. It is, and they even made a sequel. I don't know if the sequel was on N64. I think it was on N64 too. But... Oh, so many great games. I'm looking at my shelf, and there's also, not to say in first-person shooters with Duke Nukem going on to but Doom 64 is a crazy game.
Yep. The lighting in it is great, and because like the N64 could do what Doom did really well, it did it and did it perfectly, because I remember some of those rooms, the stuff I was very familiar with in Doom, were, you know, tweaked a bit for the N64 version, and it just looked so different. So if you're a Doom fan, seek that version out too, because it stands out and it's very different from what it's based on, the source material.
I'm not kidding. I was playing it a couple months ago, and you cannot play that game in the dark. I don't know how I played that when it came out, but even today as a 29-year-old, that game scares the crap out of me. The atmosphere is outstanding. The enemies have like really great detail. Like, it's actually a really nice high-res, you know, version of Doom with the way that they did like the 3D and stuff. So give that a look. And also, just like Duke Nukem 64, it's like $10 on eBay if you want to go check it out. It's not a big investment.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with it. It's way better than that new remake they did recently.
Oh, which one did they? Oh,
there's like a PSN collection.
Oh yeah. Well, have you checked out Brutal Doom? Have you checked out anything that's like that where it's just like super gory, the mods that they've done? That's an interesting game. Go look up YouTube videos of Brutal Doom. And also, I wrote a note that I forgot to mention. If you want a really great PS1 soundtrack, I got this game for $5 brand new at Babbage's, and that is Nitrous Oxide, N2O.
Oh, yeah. N2O was so good.
Great soundtrack. That was like crazy soundtrack, too.
The soundtrack is so good, and it had all this crazy lighting for the PS1, which was awesome. And it plays beautifully. It's almost like a... It's like an inverted Tempest in a way, right? Like,
that's a great way to describe it.
And it's so fast, and the frame rate's so like locked in and great. It's a very good game. We played the hell out of that game back at Next Gen when it came out, and it was always on rotation there. And it was one of those games you would show to kind of show off what the PlayStation could do as well.
We're coming up on an hour, so I want to make sure we take time. And first, I just want to thank everyone that is supporting the show on Patreon at patreon.com/backmyplay. Means a lot. And again, I want to mention again, thank you to everyone who has sent messages of support and whatnot. But before we do go, Mike, what should we keep an eye out for? Because I know, Other Ocean, you guys, it's not just the IDARB factory, like you said.
Yeah.
Are you guys working on other stuff? Is there stuff, coming down the road, or not that you need to announce anything, but just curious if you guys are, just IDARB or whatnot.
Oh, so we've announced these things and they're coming out really soon. So we'll have soon you'll see Street Fighter 4, Ultra Street Fighter 4 on PS4. We're working on that port.
Oh, awesome.
We are also working on the port of Super Time Force, the Vita. which looks beautiful on
Vita.
Thank
you. Come on. I need that game like right now.
It's so good. I feel dirty being able to play it before everybody else, it's perfect for the Vita. It's so good.
I was tweeting at them like months ago when it like came out to PS4, and I know it's like, says like, come on, we got to get this on the Vita. Get it on the Vita. And then now lo and behold, of course, you guys are working on it. That game is just kick ass. I just have been wanting to play it.
We love
that
game. Nice. We love the game. We love the guys at Cappy, who are amazing to work with. Nathan and the whole team there are phenomenal. And they want it on Vita just as bad as everybody else. So it's just been a dream project to work on. That's all coming. And then our E3 is going to be pretty exciting. We got a lot of stuff coming along, but also we're going to be we'll be announcing some cool things in regards to our efforts for game preservation and game emulation.
Fantastic.
And that sort of thing. So we've got some big news coming along that way. What else do we have cooking? We just launched the Magic 8-Ball for Apple Watch, working with Mattel. It's a smaller project, but it was just kind of interesting because it got us access to the Apple Watch early and got to play around with that. And it turned out really well. So it's just like a fun thing where, ask the Magic 8-Ball anything you want. And it's pretty interesting. There's a few twists to it as well.
I'm so bummed mine didn't ship today. I might have to wait 4 more weeks.
Oh, it's brutal. It's hard to get one right now. And
I bought it like at 3:03 a.m.
I know. We also have we launched a game called Radboarding on iOS and Android, which is great. It's a sort of like if SSX were taking place at the end of the world, and it's the apocalypse. So it's a weird snowboarding end of the world game. So we have that out there. What else do we have? We launched Yu-Gi-Oh! On tablet with Konami, and it's an awesome card battling game. We work with Konami and Konami Japan to come up with that game, which turned out really well. And we have so much going on, I even forget.
I'm downloading Radboarding right now for my
phone. Oh, there you go. Awesome. And then we'll have I can't talk about that one. But again, we have, of course, all the iDarb updates coming too.
Awesome. That's great. That is so Super Street Fighter 4 is Ultimate Super Street Fighter. Man, these names are just great.
I know.
I think we probably talked about how awesome that downloadable content was for Dead Rising 3 when they just made fun of all those names. But so is there a release date out for that? And I'm guessing that's...
I don't know for sure what the official release date is off the top of my head, but I think it's this summer.
Okay, cool. You guys are staying busy.
We are staying really busy.
So anything else that people should keep an eye out for? Are you going to be doing any conventions this year? I know you mentioned E3. Are there any plans to do any of the – I know there's a couple of retro conventions up in Seattle and Oregon and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm going to try to get out to these as much as possible this year because there's not going to be as much stress to get to deadlines for my project. So I'm trying to get out to – there's a retro show coming up in Austin in July. I'm trying to get out to – there's actually a show up, I think, in Denver. I'm going to try to get out to – and then – probably Portland Retro and those sorts of things. I'm going to try to get up to those in PAX. And, of course, E3. I'm going to be at the Game Marketing Summit this week on Wednesday in San Francisco.
Nice.
And I get to tell the story of iDarb and kind of like the magic, miraculous story of how it got marketed that we just talked about on the show. So if you already heard it, then don't go. And what else do I have cooking? There's a few other things coming up soon, too. I think I'm going to be up at XDS, which is an event up in Vancouver, mm-hmm. too. So it's going to be a busy, busy year. And I've been working on these other weird, like the Atari documentary, the Atari Dig documentary was great. It's on Showtime and on Netflix now.
That's right.
And there's been all kinds of craziness that's come from that as well. So I got my hands full on things similar to that coming up, too. So it's been a little crazy. But I can always make time for this show because this is where it's all at.
Well, you forgot the biggest news, and that's when are we going to be getting the Neo Geo Pocket Color port of iDarb with link cable, link cable support?
We got to do that pretty quick. I would love to do that.
Jeez, I literally bought a Neo Geo Pocket Color game this past week. I bought Dynamite Slugger, I thought Baseball Stars had its own game on Neo Geo Pocket Color, but this is Baseball Stars, like with all the animation and the cutscenes and stuff.
It looks great.
It's $10. If you want, if you're, maybe if you're still listening to this, they have brand new box copies of this on Amazon.com for $10. So,
oh, right now on US Amazon?
Yeah.
Okay. I got to go pick that up.
Okay. Yeah. You can look it up. I can't type and talk.
Yeah, I'll look it up. I definitely need to get that.
You can never have too many box copies of Neo Geo Pocket Color games. Yeah, it was just some like random like Japanese seller. It's a Japanese version, but obviously it's region free and it switches to English when you put it in the English console. So, well, that is going to be doing it for this episode of Back of My Play. Don't forget, you can follow Mike on Twitter at Mike J. Micah. I am at Kevin Larrabee, and of course at Back in My Play. I'm not sure what the next episode is going to be just yet. It is going to be
awesome.
Well, it's going to be awesome, but it's going to be completely dependent on if I can play through Klonoa on the flight or I've never fallen in love with a game so fast and just like, and thank you, Sony, for putting it out for a buck.
There was an old bit of trivia that said Klonoa is actually Pac-Man's cat. Did you know that?
Of course it is, because it's Namco.
Yeah. I remember, and then it explains why he has the Pac-Man hat and everything else, but like I remember there's old lore about Klonoa being his cat. So there you go.
All I need, you know, it's just living up to what they're doing with Dig Dug and all their other franchises of just incredibly deep lore that I would never think would exist.
Makes no sense.
It doesn't, but, and of course, backofmyplay.com, you can subscribe on iTunes, and that is going to do it. Mike, thank you so much. This is always just I didn't even need notes. Just it's a blast to get on Skype and to talk about old games, but maybe next time we get to line it up with a game specific episode, because it's always great to get your insights on all these old games and how they hold up today.
That would be awesome. Thanks for having me.